Hello from London, and welcome to another European Football Special Superpod, the podcast that's all over the beautiful game on the other side of the English Channel. I'm Graham Sibley, and for the next hour or so, I'll be staring aghast with slack-jawed incredulity at the unhealthy amount of knowledge emanating from the assembled panel of football bloggers and podcasters, some of who, it may surprise you to learn, have partners. With me, this time, as last time, we have James Appel from Cynical Challenge and ITV.com. James, I'm not going to do the Russian thing this time.
I was looking forward to some new translation.
Oh, no, not this time. The Wildish. We also have Chris Oakley from Football Fairground.
Hello. How's it going?
We also have Jonathan from Just Football.
Good evening.
And we also have Terry DeFellin from Football Fairground.
Hello. And also...
And with me, pushing all the buttons and doing all the sliders, is Chris Nee from Two Footed Tackle Podcast.
Good evening.
Right. So, first off, we are going to talk about the previous weekend's Euro 2012 qualifiers. And the biggest story to come out of it was a game that didn't actually finish. And that was a game against Italy, well, with Italy and Serbia. James, you watched it. Tell us what actually happened and then sort of go into some of the details behind it.
Well, I must admit, I wasn't intending to watch it, and then checked Twitter just before scheduled kickoff, and Gabriel Marcotti was doing a minute-by-minute report on fans rioting, flares being let off, plexiglass being broken, and awful words being sung. So I tuned straight in. I've done a little bit of research into this, and the reasons behind it, the motivations of the people involved, kind of can be split into broadly two categories. There's a school of thought that says this is a footballing incident, and there's another which says it's a political incident. And broadly speaking, you know, you can separate out reasons into either of those two. So, for example, there's a lot of talk in the Serbian press this morning about the rivalry between Red Star Belgrade and Partizan Belgrade, their fans, and the fact that Vladimir Stojkovic, who was supposed to be Serbia's starting goalkeeper yesterday, was attacked by a group of fans on the way into the stadium and effectively asked not to play. As a result of the fact that he used to play for Red Star and is now on loan at Partizan. So, I mean, there's a major footballing kind of needle that kind of feeds into this. But there's so many political, you know, overtly political, you know, undertones in this entire thing. There were fans sat on the railings at the Luigi Ferraris Stadium in Genoa on Tuesday, burning Albania flags. There were large groups of fans singing "Kill the Albanians." Just on a slightly lighter note, if you watch any YouTube videos of the actual, you know, rioting, you'll hear them the Serb fans singing "Ubi Šiptarja," which is kill the Albanians, but they're doing so to this tune of Karma Chameleon, which I do find a little bit incongruous.
Albanians, they come and go, don't they?
I mean, there's all sorts of things going on in Serbia at the moment. Hillary Clinton's over there discussing the future of Kosovo. And of course, the whole point of the Albanians and all of these pronouncements on the subject is that Kosovars are effectively ethnic Albanians, and it seems to be, you know, a major kind of hook on which a lot of Serbian football violence is being hung on at the moment. But I mentioned earlier that there's a football issue and a political issue. These have got so mixed up in the kind of analysis of the violence on Tuesday night in Genoa. To give you a microcosm, there are reports that the fans, and indeed some of the players, were saluting each other with three fingers. They were holding up, for the benefit of those who can't see, which is everybody except those in the studio, their thumb and index and middle fingers, like so.
Ah, like in Inglourious Bastards. When they're in the bar at the bottom. If you haven't seen that film, then
that hasn't added anything to it.
Now, a number of commentators have intelligently suggested that this is uh, This is the mimicking the salute of the Serbian Nationalist Party created by Vuk Drašković.
Sounds like a baddie.
he's not a nice man, I'll tell you that. In 1990, he basically formed a very ultra-nationalist right-wing Serbian organisation that effectively kind of powered the insurrections and the Yugoslav wars in the mid-90s. They used to salute each other with a three-finger salute. There are others, however, who suggest that the fans and the players were ironically suggesting to the Italians that they were offering them their 3 points. So, whichever side you believe, the point is to be made is that this is a really nasty, complex issue, and it doesn't look like it's going to be resolved very soon.
Yeah, there was a strange moment in there, wasn't it, when the Serbian players actually applauded the fans? Was this ironic or was this supportive you can't imagine that it was in any way supportive, but
I've seen the footage and it looks really strange. It does look as though the players, at least some members of the playing staff, made a point of going over to the corner of the stadium where the Serbian fans were rioting and actually, you know, saluting and applauding them. That's not to say that all footballers or even some footballers are on the side of these, for want of a better phrase, nutters. Mm. Savo Milosevic was interviewed on Serbian television earlier today, and he is really, really upset, understandably, about what's happened. And in fact, he suggests that there's something really, you know, fundamentally wrong with Serbian sport at the moment. I'll quote some of the things he says, if you don't mind, which he says, "Do not confuse cause and causes. These young people, i.e. the ones rioting in the stadium on Tuesday, are not the problem. They are the result. We need to find the cause. These young people are under instructions. Why the state does not respond, I really don't know. Sport has remained the last bastion in the reorganisation of our state. The state has no interest in watching sport, and that backfires on it, and we are paying a high price." Now, there's so much about Serbian sport which is wrapped up in ultra-nationalist politics. And as you say, it is interesting to see players applauding the fans. But let's not forget, we've seen some studies have suggested that a match involving, I think it was Partizan Belgrade and Croatia Zagreb, actually in 1991, I think, kicked off the Yugoslav wars.
Red Star and Partizan. Red Star and Dinamo Zagreb.
Dinamo Zagreb. That's right.
And it is the Red Star. The Red Star. I can't pronounce their. It begins with a G. Jilalia or their ultras.
Hardmen.
Heroes or hardmen. It sometimes translates as well. They actually reckon that it was they who actually kicked it all off the Balkan wars with that 3,000 person riot. It was apparently was one of the was atrocious. It was it was awful. So there's they've definitely got a history of the Red Star ultras have been linked certainly with Arkan.
That's right.
Today as well. And they're said to be a part of them a fairly complex and at times nasty, but in other ways, you know. Not they're a hooligan fraternity, nasty pieces of work. Was there not some suggestion as well? I don't know whether you found this out or whether this is something that you unearthed in your research, that there was some legacy from a very recent Pride march in Belgrade that was sabotaged again. It's said by sports or football hooligans. As recently as maybe last weekend, or I don't know.
It was. So, I mean, certainly it has been suggested that the Pride march in Belgrade was a kind of forerunner to this. But equally, I've seen some reports in the Serbian press that have been listing in the last year and a half or so the various misdemeanours of football fans trying to keep it within the boundaries of football. You know, And, for example, last August, Red Star fans rioted in Prague before they were playing Slavia. The same month, Partizan fans attacked the team in the mixed zone after a game against MSK Žilina. Earlier this year, in May, prior to the World Cup, the Serbian team played a friendly against New Zealand in Austria, which they lost 1-0, and Serbian fans rioted after that.
I think weren't Partizan kicked out of the UEFA Cup a couple of seasons ago?
No, the incident wasn't there an incident last year when their fans were responsible for the death of a Toulouse fan?
That's right. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So, all in all, a load of nasty pieces of work that European competition is probably better off without. I think that's
UEFA have predictably launched an investigation into this, but in light of everything that's going on, that's happened before, what do you foresee being the outcome of that, James? I mean, is it going to be sort of points deductions or bans, or is it just going to be a heavy fine, like heavy in quotes?
It strikes me that UEFA really prefer a hands-off approach to a lot of these issues. Last night, for example, as players had left the pitch and some of them had got changed and were leaving the stadium, the UEFA delegate, who was a Georgian, actually, was still briefing the press, telling him that the game was going to go ahead.
Oh, yes.
I think that that kind of, to me, encapsulates the attitude of UEFA, which is that the show must go on. Mm. You know, the schedule should not be messed with. The rules are there and should not be broken.
Well, they're also probably thinking about the horror of having to reschedule the match more than anything else. I mean, because they're going to have to. If they didn't do it then the UEFA officials might be thinking, well, look, one possible outcome is that we're going to have to come back and do all of this all over again on another day.
Well, I think, Terry, the idea that this match is going to be replayed as now, you know, is completely...
Yeah. No, of course.
But there's a line been drawn under
it. If you're a UEFA official, you're thinking about all the possibilities, and one of the possibilities must surely be, if you have this the show must go on approach, then we think, well, if we don't play it now, when do we play it? And maybe at some point someone will say, well, actually, you never play it. You award Italy with a 3-0 win. And...
It's very rare, after occasions like this, that a team can gather itself and go on and start winning matches again. So in terms of the actual outcome, the long-term outcome, which is the qualification process and whether Serbia can qualify, I think that's already over. We can pretty much say now Serbia won't be going to Poland and Ukraine in 2012. So I think UEFA would probably, and I don't at all wish to sort of second guess these things, because it goes on in the lobbies of power far above my station, but they would probably rather that the end was satisfied without messing around with the means, i.e. they won't be cancelling games, they won't be withholding points or anything like that. They would just keep their fingers crossed that, as is expected, the situation will play itself out and Serbia will not be qualifying.
Well, it certainly looks that way at the moment. Moving to matters on the pitch, Chris Nee, do you think Italy will think that they've got away with something here? I mean, like, you know, they didn't look fantastic against Northern Ireland. So do you think actually this has fallen quite well for them?
Well, yeah, it could be. Of course, they may find themselves open to punishment as well, given that it was their stadium and so much of this happened inside. But if they're awarded 3 points for this, they really are in the box seat for qualification, despite, as you say, looking singularly unimpressive on Friday evening.
Mm. Yeah, against a team that couldn't beat the Faroe Islands 3 days later.
No, well, Italy kind of pulled the strings for much of the game without really being particularly dangerous. And as it turns out, Northern Ireland had basically no possession for the entire game and had the one chance that really should have been put away in order to win it, David Healy's missed sitter of a header in the first half. So, I mean, they could legitimately have gone or stayed there with 3 points.
Yeah, it's a fascinating group, actually. Italy, Serbia, Northern Ireland. They're also there with Slovenia, obviously, who've had quite success in qualifying recently. So it's quite a mixed-up group. It's very difficult to see who's actually really going to come through from that one. But obviously, Italy look like they're set fair now. Even though there's only a couple of points between the top four teams.
It's difficult to see any of them, really. I think, obviously, Northern Ireland, we've had some unimpressive results. Slovenia are doing okay and probably will end up taking a playoff position if there is one in that group, rather than automatically going through. And you know, Italy really are the standout team despite that poor result on Friday.
Yeah. Moving over to you, Jonathan, and talk about the world champions, Spain, who didn't have it all their own way against Scotland, did they?
No, it was a fascinating game, in fact. The pre-match build-up was all about Scotland's approach and the kind of 4-6-0 formation that Craig Levine had masterminded and was preparing for Spain. As if Spain aren't used to playing teams who play 10 men behind the ball anymore. To a point, I mean, it was an interesting kind of, it was a classic kind of, you know, case study of attacking versus defence in the first half, and Scotland performed it fairly well. But the, you know, at the heart of the debate about attacking versus defending and all-out attack versus all-out defence, if you're a team that is all-out defending, No matter how well you do, you're always subject to, you know, one error, and then the game is completely changed, and you're kind of like stuck. Where do you go from there? And that was what happened. I think with a few minutes before half time, Stephen Whittaker handballed it in the box needlessly, and you know, they were awarded a penalty, and David Villa scored it. And obviously, from there, from Spain's point of view, you're thinking, well, our entire game plan is based around defending, and we're 1-0 down now. So, you know, where do you go from there? They went 2-0 down, and then, incredible, you know, you thought the game was over, the Hampden Park was silent, and then incredibly out of nowhere they managed to come back and make it 2-2. An own goal from PK, and a header from, I think it was Nathan, I can't quite remember, but it was, isn't it? yeah, and you know, they just really out of nowhere they came back. But Spain proved, you know, just what a great side they are, and the amount of different options they have. And, you know, they're not just a fantastic passing side. One of the great elements of Spain's play and, you know, their team is that they have many different types of styles of play. And Del Bosque changed it. He brought on Llorente, Atletico Bilbao. He's, you know, massive player. And, you
blue-eyed
know, physically, beast. Yeah, blue-eyed beast. And he came on, and Pablo Hernandez as well for Valencia, who's an out-and-out winger. And they just started to, you know, get the ball down the wings and cross it in, and that was where the goal came from. So in the end, it was attack versus defence, and attack prevailed.
The funny thing about that game is I don't really see the Spanish, despite their impeccable record over the last few years, as an arrogant side. You know, they play excellent football, but they don't tend to take the mickey out of other teams. But I noticed when Llorente scored the winner, he very, very kind of openly gestured that he was wiping his brow as if to say, phew, that was close. And I thought to myself, that's the first time I thought, God, I don't like you. God, I wish Scotland would get a couple now and I want you to get sent off. It was a real watershed moment for me watching Spain. I don't know how you felt about it, Jonathan.
Well, I'm sorry, Jonathan, but I honestly, when I saw the fixture, I did sort of think that, you know, are Spain gonna play this, like, you know, the Harlem Globetrotters? Are they gonna like maybe bringing out like stepladders? We're gonna change the name of Scotland to the Washington Generals.
It was like watching Brazil v Derby. Brazil v Ukraine, and I thought for a moment that it was, especially some of the refereeing decisions. I thought, this is Harlem Globetrotters, isn't it? And out come the stepladders.
But it really was. I mean, in the first half, you know, the lines couldn't be more defined in terms of like the attacking and defending, as we mentioned, and you know, Xabi Alonso, for example, completed over 100 passes, which, it, you know, the Scotland supporters were cheering if a ball was cleared out for a throw-in, you know, after 22 minutes. You know, it really was. You know, we're gonna hang on for dear life here and see what we can do.
Yeah, but it makes that comeback even the more remarkable, doesn't it? Really, I mean, I wish I'd watched that instead of the bloody 0-0 draw that I did watch.
It's sort of a conundrum, though. I mean, to an extent, in terms of, you know, they showed with the two goals that they had the ability to open up Spain to an extent. I mean, whether or not it was a case of Spain taking their eye off the ball, you know, you could obviously argue that as well. But it kind of, as ever with this kind of defensive mentality, it always I always wonder, you know, is it really advantageous to just defend for your, you know, for your life, or is it better to attack? And it kind of brought out that whole argument again when they came back from 2-0 down. You know, part of me was wondering, well, if they had started like this in the first place, you know, they could have perhaps have arguably gone 2-0 up. But obviously, that depends on your interpretation of Spain maybe taking their eye off the ball when they took the 2-0 lead. But it's an interesting one to, you know, consider.
Is there a possibility?
If they'd gone for it in the beginning, would they have been just ruthlessly carved open, or would
lost
they
5-2?
It raises that question. But
yeah, it's a tough old group because they've got Czech Republic in there as well, and Czech Republic won both their games, one against Scotland, and the other one, all right, was against Liechtenstein. But it looks like the group I is going to be, as would have been quite predictable at the beginning of it, going to be carved up with Spain running away with it and Czech Republic going in for the playoff spot. Anything to say that Scotland could cause an upset there or not, or do you think
based on their play? I mean, as I say, in those moments where they did attack and show some sort of intent, they looked fairly decent. They played Darren Fletcher in a more advanced role. Phil Bardsley made his debut at right back. You know, Craig Levein certainly is trying new things and bringing in new options, and you know, I think they can take some encouragement from the performance. Certainly, they were clapped off at the end. You know, the Scottish fans in the ground were very proud of the performance. Whether or not they can qualify, it remains to be seen, because they do tend to have trouble. The last game, they narrowly snatched a point, or was it they?
Scotland. They lost to the Czech Republic.
Yeah. Yeah, but the game before that at Hampden Park, was it Liechtenstein or Lithuania?
They won in the last.
So they are liable for, you know, for the odd kind of upset.
Well, they are providing good entertainment though at Hampden. That's for sure.
But the most important thing, hopefully, is that, you know, Spain should advance being the holders. That should be really a given.
Okay, well, let's move on to you, Chris Oakley, and I think we can talk about France and about how they're getting on in their qualification campaign. A new look France, how's it going so far?
It's looking pretty good, actually, for France. Laurent Blanc seems to be slowly but surely kind of knitting together the basis for a strong, reliable team. Their campaign didn't start too well. They lost to Belarus, which kind of got them on the back foot. But they've bounced back in their double header that they had at the weekend, or playing on Saturday and on Tuesday. They got a good 2-0 win against Romania, and then they they beat Luxembourg 2-0 as well. Both games kind of similar in a way, in that France played well, very good passing and movement and so on and so forth, but perhaps looked a little bit sort of blunt up front. They just kind of not quite got the clinical finish that they needed, that they need to really finish off teams in an emphatic kind of way. But they're certainly good enough and playing a lot better now than they were. Against Luxembourg, as you'd expect, dare I say, with Luxembourg being the weaker team of the two by far, it was pretty much one-way traffic for France. And against Romania, not really the team that they used to be at the moment. And France were playing quite comfortably against them as well. But in both games, you sort of wondered, to some extent, when are they going to sort of score? Are they going to be able to score, you know, maybe 2-3 goals to really kind of finish the tie off? And they got two in both. But the key really that Laurent Blanc has hit on is getting a settled defence. Philippe Metchez, who's a Roma defender, he's really becoming the sort of star of their defence, to my mind, really. He does a lot of these kind of marauding runs upfield. He gets the ball and he drives upfield and instigates the next attack. But he's also in defence got Revaillère and Clichy and Ramy as well. And he's made slight adjustments, slight tweaks in defence, but essentially he's pretty much keeping everything settled there, and he seems to have got that worked out. So they're not conceding goals at the moment. And then in the rest of the team, you've got some of your old familiar faces like Malouda and Gourcuff and Benzema and so on and so forth. So it's looking much more positive for France now. They're top of the group now.
Because he's playing Nasri now as well, isn't he?
Yeah.
Obviously without Ribery there. Mm-hmm. Nasri wasn't actually in the World Cup squad, was he?
No, that's right. Yeah. But he looked good. He seemed to figure more, to my mind, in the Romania game. And he was looking excellent. He sort of seems to be sort of fitting into the system pretty well. And in some ways, they are benefiting now, France, from having sort of put to one side some of the old names from the past that would seem to be kind of, you know, the egos were complicating the issue.
Ooh, that somewhat. Sounds horribly familiar.
Yes. And as you say, Ribery, I think he's injured at the moment, so they don't have to kind of worry too much about him. So they're not quite playing to 100% of their potential, France, but they are looking a lot better than they were, and I think given time, Laurent Blanc will get them performing well, but it might take a while. But they've still got Belarus for company at the top of the group, but all things taken into consideration, they should win out, and if they carry on playing the way they will, they should win that group, France.
Just quickly, a player who sort of caught my eye with Saint-Etienne, sort of riding high in the league, is Dimitri Payet.
Yes.
And he earned his first call-up, mm-hmm. I think recently, of reunionese descent. How did he do in the... Did he get much playing time?
Yes, he did. He played well. And this is, again, sort of symptomatic, really, of how Laurent Blanc is constructing the French team. He's not afraid to give players a debut or to give them rare starts if he thinks they're doing really well in the league form. And Dimitri Payet is actually the top goal scorer in Ligue 1 at the moment. He's got 7 goals, and I think under previous coaches, players like that maybe wouldn't have been tried out too much. But Laurent Blanc's done this with a few players, and he's sort of gone, yeah, okay, give you a chance. And he did play well against Luxembourg. So one for the future. He's only, I think, 21 at the moment, Dimitri Payet, but he's on top form for Saint-Etienne, has helped them drive them to... Well, they were top of the league up until the last round of games about a week or two ago. They're second in the league now, so he's
his free kick against Lyon in the derby was magnificent.
Yeah, he's a bit special, as they say. Yes.
A better option than Kevin Davis up front, then, would you
well,
say?
Well, you know, not every side gets a chance to put in a Kevin Davis, but, you know, France's loss, I suppose, really.
Yes, well... Elsewhere in Group D, the points are being shared quite evenly, really. Bosnia are perhaps disappointing a little, sitting only on 4 points from 3 games. And as you rightly said, Romania have yet to win from their 3 games. Mm. So it puts Albania in third, which you don't normally expect to see Albania reaching those heady heights. Do we reckon they're going to hold that position there, James?
No,
what?
It's all about Belarus in this group.
They
are actually a good side.
Have they got anyone else other than the Chleb brothers then, or is it?
They have a guy called Vitaly Kutuzov who has played for Parma. I think he might even still be at Parma. And he's a forward player who gets a lot of press in Russia because he's one of the few people who they can claim as a kind of expatriate Russian doing well abroad in Europe. They're always very keen on that. And they also have a lot of players who've done really well for Bato Borisov in Europe in the last few seasons. Borisov, quite an unusual team, from really sort of out in the sticks in Belarus, have sort of overtaken Dynamo Minsk as Belarus's number one team. And they've got a couple of really good players who I think another couple of seasons and they'll either end up in the Russian Premier League or else go west.
Yeah. Okay.
I guess those Serbian hooligans won't be too pleased to see Albania there in third.
Doing better than them, yeah. As you'd expect, as usual, the Dutch are 100% in their qualifying campaign in Group E, running away with it ahead of Hungary on 9 points and Sweden on 6. But another team that are 4 from 4 are Germany. So Terry, another usual stroll to yet another tournament for Germany.
Yeah, it seems so. It's just a continuation from where they picked off in July, really. There doesn't appear to have been any break. There was a little bit of off-the-field shenanigans between Philip Lahm and Michael Ballack, but Ballack's injured and out of the picture, so he hasn't come back in. No apparent ill effects from the Khedira and Mesut Ozil going to Real Madrid. Their first win, or well, their win for our weird discussions on Friday against Turkey could have been a really tricky one for them. Effectively a derby game, and the modern Germany being the modern Germany, they decided to hold it where they could find the most Turkish supporters to come along to the football match in Berlin, rather than say go to Bavaria or go to Dortmund or somewhere like that. They say no, we'll go and have it in the big barn of a place in the Olympic Stadium, so that plenty of Turks can come along and watch their team play. And Ozil was, perhaps it was suggested Ozil would have a difficult time of things because of his background and his ethnic background, and yet he scored a very good goal, sandwiched between two, you'd have to say, ubiquitous Miroslav Klose goals, and the enigma that is Miroslav Klose, it just continues to be an enigma. I mean, nobody quite knows why he's so good for Germany and so not good for Bayern Munich. But
he just to butt in there, he's been sort of a bit vocal this week, hasn't he? He's been basically sort of saying, "I'll happily walk away from Bayern if it helps me stay in the keep my place in the national team."
Yeah, I mean, he must be thinking to himself, "Well, look, you know, I mean, there must be. It can't just be me, who is just so blur at Bayern Munich, and yet can turn up for the international games." I mean, I feel that. I mean, I think that Bayern probably need to have a bit of a clear out up front anyway, because I don't really know what's going on. But certainly they could do far worse than cutting their losses and sending Miroslav Klose back to Werder Bremen, where he came from and where he'll almost certainly score an absolute heap of goals. Or maybe Stuttgart, to plug the gap that still hasn't been filled by Mario Gomez, who left season before last. So yeah, and obviously a fairly straightforward win on Tuesday against Kazakhstan.
I think Mike picked that up nicely. Yeah.
And
it's my part of the world. Yeah, I can't really help myself.
I didn't get the chance to have a look at that game, unfortunately, because it was repeated very late night on ESPN, and I had to go to work the next day. So
it is interesting you called it a sort of a straightforward win, because I think that Turkey's example and Germany's example over the last couple of games sort of is a perfect encapsulation of how Germany steamroll their way through qualifying it, and how other teams can find it difficult. You know, Turkey go to Germany, what looks like a big tie, lots of, you know, German-born Turks and Turkish-born Germans, you know, dotted around either team. Gus Hiddink, the tactical master, and what happens? Germany completely walks.
3-0.
Exactly. And then both teams have to go away to really sort of nasty, you know, former Soviet bloc countries. And I'm not going to bother going into the differences between Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan for our purposes. Let's be fair.
That will have to wait for another day.
Yeah. But yes, for our purposes, it's all pretty much the same beer. So and of course Germany win 3-0, and Turkey go down 1-0 in Baku, which sort of, I think to me that just encapsulates Germany as a footballing nation,
as a sporting character. Yeah. They are cutting a new figure as gallant losers, Germany, which was something that they haven't been terribly good at in the past, and they've always been very, very good winners, to be honest with you. But they do seem to be taking on this mantle of heroic losers, but they're doing it also in the best pantomime villain style, by doing it in the biggest possible stage, getting as far in a competition as possible before finally losing.
It's like the people you hate in Big Brother, isn't it, really? They just stick around forever, and you think, why, who is voting these people in?
I saw the Kazakhstan-Germany games, and I had to rub my eyes plenty of times in sheer disbelief at something I've not seen for a long time, which was Mario Gomez scoring a goal.
Just, a sight that... I thought you were about to talk about the halftime entertainment in Kazakhstan.
Should I be talking about that?
Apparently it consisted of a woman standing in the centre circle with a microphone shouting Kazakhstan repeatedly for the whole 15 minutes.
Like, this sounds exactly like it's straight out of Borat.
Yeah.
Terry, have you got any idea about who's going to go through with Germany? Because obviously Germany are going to walk this group, and who's going to get the playoff place? Is it going to be Austria? Is it going to be Turkey? Is it going to be Belgium?
Well, I understand the situation with Belgium is that they've got some fantastic players, but they just don't take being Belgian terribly seriously. So they need to take a slither of Serbian nationalism and then graft it onto them. Then maybe they might turn up for games.
There's all the Walloonies are on one side and all the Flems are on the other side.
Yeah, I reckon there's probably a big nasty sort of like, you know, Huntington style sort of like fault line in the Belgian dressing room. and it's grim stuff. So I would say Belgium, and I would like to see Belgium, because they're doing wonderful things and they deserve, as a footballing nation, to get some recognition.
Yeah, and the beer's great.
And the beer is fabulous as well. But, I mean, Austria is intriguing, and I'm looking forward to seeing them, to see just how... There is a... I detect a mini revival in Austria. Mm. I understand their youth setup is decent.
You're nodding your head there, Chris. No,
I was just going to say my money's on Austria. They just look pretty.
Well, I like Marco Arnautovic, and Erwin Hoffer, who play in the Bundesliga. Erwin Hoffer used to play for Napoli. Arnautovic came from Real Madrid, I think, on loan from last season. He's at Werder Bremen, and Erwin Hoffer is now at Kaiserslautern. And Arnautovic looks precocious. Really, really, really special player, but apparently he's an absolute git. That looks like a really, really interesting group. But they may end up, all the opposition may end up just eating each other, and while Germany sort of serenely sail off into the distance.
James, Russia topped their group. They managed a 1-0 win away to Macedonia. How do you see things panning out in that group?
Well, Group B has been a bit like a kind of. So game of pass the parcel, in which everybody's kind of trying to sort of lose games and passing like the number one spot in that group around one another until the music will finally stop and Russia will qualify. when they lost last month against Slovakia at home, the Russian press made out, you know, like it was, you know, the end of the world. Two games later, the 2 points clear at the top, everyone else is dropping points, and look at plucky Armenia coming in second.
Yeah, look at them.
Armenia, incidentally, I wouldn't necessarily say they're ones for the future. They haven't quite reached that stage, but they do have some good players. They've got a guy called Mkhitaryan, something like that anyway, who has been scoring the goals for them. They also had a guy who used to play at Ajax called Manucharian, who doesn't do much at club level, but certainly does a lot for the national team. So they've got some good players. But yeah, it's really a case of Ireland and Slovakia dropping points against one another, against teams unexpectedly. And Russia, kind of, they went away to Macedonia on Tuesday. They played awfully, you know. Akinfeev had to save a penalty. It was all hands to the pump in the last 10 minutes, and it felt like, you know, Macedonia were the team who were sort of, you know, the qualifying, you know, the ones expected to qualify, and Russia were the sort of plucky underdogs. And yet they came away with the win, and they're top of the group now. So I'm sure that's the way it'll stay for the rest of qualifying.
You're thinking of Yuromov Sisian?
Yes, him as well.
Yeah, former MLS.
Really?
Yeah, up until last season they moved to Denmark, I think. He was at Real Salt Lake, and he's a very impressive player.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't mean that in a shaking my head. I actually, there are a few young Armenians coming through, and interesting, for the first time really in Armenian history, Armenia has an enormous diaspora. There are basically about 2 or 3 million people living in Armenia itself. There are about 11 million Armenians living outside, ethnic Armenians. They include people such as Alan Bogossian used to play for France. It was an international for France, and Yuri Djurkov as well. And also, for those of you who are into your light entertainment, Cher is also a part Armenian.
Very light. System of a Down.
Really?
Yep.
Excellent. So many Armenians from all walks of life. And finally...
Isn't Kim Kardashian Armenian?
I'm sure she is. In fact, should we play a game? Everyone name an Armenian.
I'm Armenian!
And the upshot of it is it's the first generation of people who may have been born outside Armenia, who are Armenian, you know, ethnic Armenians, who are prepared to, you know, go back and play for their national team, and they will benefit enormously as a result. So keep your eye out on Armenians in future.
But the million-dollar question is, will they beat the Republic of Ireland to a qualification spot? Or is it too early for them? Do you see it more next time around?
Well, without... Not indirectly answering your question, I actually think Slovakia are probably the second best team in that group.
Right,
and I think Chris may have an opinion on this knee because he's very keen on Marek Hamšík, and so am I.
How dare you?
not in that way.
He's a good-looking fellow. Come on.
And we all saw what Slovakia did to Italy in their World Cup group. So I had high hopes for Slovakia, and they just very disappointingly lost against Armenia. I think they can reasonably say they dropped points against Ireland on Tuesday night. You know, even though the Irish had a penalty to win the game and Robbie Keane missed it, I think the Slovaks had much of that game, and so we'll probably see Slovakia get the playoff spot in that group.
Yeah, they've done well in recent qualification campaigns as well. Right. Well, moving on. Well, I'll have a quick roundup of what else is going. What else is happening? Chris, do you want to talk through Group H there, one with Norway, Portugal, and Denmark?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Portugal and Denmark were drawn together in the last World Cup qualification, and it was a defeat against Denmark that made Portugal's run a lot more difficult than it needed to be. How are Portugal holding up this time?
Well, of course, new coach. In charge, and he's done the unthinkable, and he's managed to get Cristiano Ronaldo to score in two games on the trot. Portugal beat Iceland 3-1, and they seem to be sort of scoring goals again now, and getting the best out of players. Raul Morelles, of course, Liverpool's own Raul Morelles, scored in that game against Iceland, and they just sort of seem to be sort of far more cohesive now than they were, and they're up to second in that group.
Yeah,
as you say,
they didn't do
Norway.
That well in the first two games, but they've won the last two. Norway are topping the group, three wins from three, and Denmark is sitting third at the moment.
Mm.
Yes, in another small group. Over in Group F, Greece are top of the table with Croatia just a point behind. Georgia in third. Israel, Latvia and Malta making up the numbers there. That one seems to be a very, very tight group. James, Georgia, they seem to be sort of like bubbling around mid-table in nearly every qualification group they're in, and they tend to put in the occasional good result. Do you think they're sleeping giants, or do you think that's all they'll ever be?
Georgia always seems to produce one flair player a generation, don't they? You know, there was Georgie Kinkladze, and everyone remembers him, obviously. They seem to have like a technical ability, but it's not matched really by investment in their infrastructure. If you look at the stadiums, they've got like a 30, maybe 40,000 seater stadium as their national stadium. And I was watching a game. I've never been to Georgia, but I saw a game on TV that was being played in their Georgian league. And it was outside Tbilisi, and it was really being watched by three men and a cow. So I'm not surprised that Georgia don't tend to do very well, as they just don't have the facilities available to most developed footballing nations. Having said that, they're unbeaten in this qualifying series, and they look much better. They had a listeners must forgive me because I haven't necessarily prepped on Georgia this time around. But they did have Hector Cooper as manager. I'm not even sure if he might even still be there.
I think he went to Aris.
Thank you.
And then he got sacked. He only just been, I'm pretty certain, or is it Aris or is it AEK? Mm. Well, I'm sure he went to a Greek club and has recently been sacked from that Greek club. But I might be.
Sure.
I haven't done my Georgia.
I'm surprised because Aris is doing quite well at the
moment. I think it's AEK.
Right. But either way, they did for a while have Hector Cooper as national team coach, which was huge in view of the fact that he'd taken Valencia to, you know, European finals. So there's certainly a willingness on the part of the Georgian FA to encourage the development of the team, but it isn't really matched by, as I say, the building of a stadium or even a stand outside of Tbilisi.
Well, it's an interesting group because, as I say, Greece, Croatia, and Georgia are all there, and they've yet to lose a game. All those three, so it's going to go down all the way, I think, that group, and worth keeping perhaps half an eye on anyway. Which of course leaves us with Group G to discuss, if we can discuss at all. Montenegro, hats off to them, four games, still not conceded a goal. Was I the only one here who actually sat down and watched the whole game?
No.
Chris, what was your considered opinion?
Well, just give us a figure out of 10. That should cover it.
Oh, I thought it was really very disappointing. Obviously, credit has to go to Montenegro, who showed up and did what they presumably intended to do. But actually, within the confines of the 90 minutes, I still think that we've got a legitimate right to be disappointed with England's performance. I think with key players missing, Montenegro were there for the taking. And I think that some crisper passing and a little bit more concentration and a better final ball would have seen us to 3 points.
I think that's being England, by the way.
Sorry, Jonathan.
I think... there's a definite contrast between England and Germany to be drawn from last night's games, from the sort of the brief bits of England I've seen. The Kazakhstan-Germany game was very similar in the sense that Kazakhstan were quite content to, clearly they didn't have too many expectations. They've yet to score in this qualifying campaign, and being plucky and holding out for as long as you can was kind of on their agenda, and eventually they were just worn down by Germany's crisp passing, as you mentioned, and their sort of slickness of play, their interchanging, and eventually Germany just wore them down and got the goals. And there's a very marked contrast, I thought, with England, where the passing is stodgy and kind of slow.
The Montenegrins came closest to actually scoring, didn't they?
Hit the bar.
10 minutes to go. So.
But they set themselves up knowing that their striker was missing, is it Vucinic, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, looking at the performance, looking at what actually happened and being able to make the judgment with hindsight, do you think the Montenegro had a chance of winning the game if Vucinic had been able to give them that kind of outlet? I would suggest that they did. They had a very good chance of winning the game. They did look at times a bit brittle, and a team with a little bit more guile might have been able to find a way through.
I think England can count themselves unlucky that they didn't get a couple of penalty shouts, because at least the handball was excuse me for quoting Andy Townsend, but stick on.
Like most of his books.
And pop up. Chris, as a Villa fan, Ashley Young, serial diver.
Yeah, I mean he is, but he is usually as good as it was last night. And it took a replay for me to be absolutely certain that it was a dive, and it's the kind of thing that you tend to get given because it's only in that split second before that there is almost inevitable contact that he goes. He's disturbingly good at it, and it's very, very irritating watching it every week.
There's a fantastic moment in the game where Kevin Davies came on, and he got booked for it. And I'm afraid I don't remember the Montenegrin player's name, or at least the name of his neck that felt the force of Davies's elbow. And a classic Davies moment where he's like jostling for the ball, elbow up into the neck, down goes the player. Now in the Premier League, it's like, maybe it gets spotted, maybe it's a free kick, and a kind of glum what? But I mean, it's like whistle, yellow card, and it's like, this is international football, and you're probably going to have to stop doing that.
It was a great moment of like Buster Keaton's silent movie sort of like kind of shrug, wasn't it? I almost expected like the top of a building to fall down on everyone or something.
I was just going to say about the diving. I don't think Ashley Young will be the first or the last England player to try the dive kind of thing, because, I mean, you've got all around him, you've got like Steven Gerrard, Peter Crouch,
Wayne Rooney,
and in the past you've had players like Michael Owen even, and Gary Lineker have all... It's a common thread, unfortunately.
England players don't dive. What are you trying to say?
I need to be the person to tell you the truth. You've reached that age where we need to tell you.
We are colossal cheats.
In Young's defence, I think there's actually a large element of him just being a bit of a wimp. Because I think a lot of his dives, not all of them, because he does have a tendency to go down pretty easily as well, but
in Young's defence, he's a wimp.
I'd rather he's a wimp than a cheat.
The podcast, haven't we?
He tends to avoid...
Young, he's not a cheat, he's a wimp.
he avoids contact when he's not diving.
Pass me the shovel if you don't.
Well, I think that brings a suitable close to a roundup of the 2012 action there. I think what we'll do now is we'll go around the table, a lightning tour of Europe. We'll have a look, see what's going on in the leagues around Europe. Yeah, that was great, wasn't it? Right, James, we'll start off with you because it's squeaky bum time in Russia.
Certainly getting there. Well, I think the squeaky bums are all going to be at the bottom, not the top.
And there's the sub headline.
Totally unintentional, that one.
I know some places you can go to where...
gather yourself. Zenit St. Petersburg have got it wrapped up. Give them the trophy already. Thank you. But at the bottom, again, it's all about the recovery of Krylia Sovetov. Krylia Sovetov from the city of Samara, and by the way, the name Krylia Sovetov translates as Wings of the Soviets, so you can tell that they haven't changed their name as well.
They're still clinging on to the
that's football.
Well, funnily enough, tangentially, Samara, the town of Samara, the city really, was a closed town during Soviet period. Basically, Stalin decided he wanted his space rockets to be built there and designed there. So for 40 or so years, it was closed to foreigners and various other members of the Soviet Union who were deemed undesirable to be hanging around looking at rockets being built and scientists going about their business. So in a sense, they you know, it's not a surprise that they've clung on to part of their, Soviet era nomenclature. But they also have a quite successful football team by the standards of Russian Premier League, in that they are the only team outside Moscow who are an ever-present in the Russian top flight since Russia became independent from the Soviet Union. They have been in trouble for some time. They decided to go on a spending spree at the height of the economic boom in the mid to late 2000s and bought Yuri Yaroshik from Chelsea and Jan Koller, who... was clearly in the twilight of his career, but obviously still scored a fair few goals in Samara. Then they started losing money and hemorrhaging really badly and then going bust, and they found themselves at the bottom of the table. Then Vladimir Putin stepped in and asked local businesses to help them out. And when I say asked, I of course mean... yes. And miraculously, having been bottom of the table for most of the season, Krylia Sovetov have started winning. So I'll leave you with the thought that perhaps, given that this is a traditional football team with a great heritage and with a very notable political supporter on their side in Vladimir Putin, they probably will escape from the relegation zone just in time for the end of the season. I'll leave you with that.
Yes, thank you very much, James. Chris Nee, let's move on to Serie A. How do you think things are going so far? Lazio still riding high.
Yes, they've been pretty impressive, actually. I've only seen one of their games, which was a win against Fiorentina. which was basically kind of masterminded a little bit by Ledesma and a little bit by Hernanez, who's had a fantastic start to the season. So they're deservedly at the top of the table. Inter, just behind them, have started to really come into their own. They look very comfortable. Doesn't seem to be too much change under their new manager. They have now lost Esteban Cambiasso for about a month, I think, and he's had a good start along with Wesley Sneijder and Samuel Eto'o, who have had fantastic starts as well. And then Napoli, who I'm of course delighted to see up near the top of the table, and have a very good claim to be one of the most exciting teams in the world to be watching at the moment, because they tend to go down a couple of goals before they wake up. But they have proven themselves very capable of coming from behind and winning.
Yeah, looking at the bottom there, Roma sort of made everyone believe that they've turned a corner by actually winning a game, but then they followed it up by losing again. Any good news for Roma fans there at all?
Yeah. Well, no. It looked as if the horrible crisis at the start of the season that they seemed to be sharing at one point with AC Milan was over with that late win over Inter. And then they pitched up at Napoli and got beaten. So it looks as if they're going to be in for a difficult ride.
Mm. Could I ask about Udinese quickly? I mean, what is the situation with them in terms... I mean, they have some of the most exciting players who are at the World Cup. Alexis Sanchez, Kwadwo Asamoah of Ghana. And they just consistently seem to be pretty poor.
Yeah, it's quite a strong league generally, and a lot of the teams that have come up, I think, are probably part of the factor why Udinese are struggling quite so much, because they're not one of the absolute best sides in the league. Teams like Chievo started very well this season. They were top at one point. Cesena have had a good start after coming up. Brescia as well have started really well. So I think there's an element of just everybody else coming out and doing really well. A lot of the sides that kind of hang around mid-table, kind of lower mid-table, have had decent starts to the season and are playing really well.
I know last year Udinese were basically carried by Di Natale's goals. And I think you can just look at the league table now and see that they've got 3 goals from 6 games, and that's really the real problem for them.
And Sanchez as well. And I've heard not a peep about Sanchez all season. Mm.
But I mean, talking about a crisis at Udinese sort of misses the point about the Serie A this season, I think, because if you look at the table, 6 games played, everybody's played. Everybody's won at least one game, and everybody's lost at least one game. And it sort of suggests, well, this is a great league to watch, and it's really tough. And like Udinese, they win 2 games in a row, they're probably up around Europa League spots.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, it's probably too early to tell.
Well, they're 9 points off the top.
Sure.
It's not that difficult.
It's a very interesting point, because I watched Parma Milan the other week, and Parma didn't look like a side that were... You know, looking like they were going to be in the bottom 3 forever, and it took an absolute wonder goal to beat them.
It's the same with Roma. They are not going to be down there when it comes to the end of the season.
Yeah.
And even on the form that they've shown so far, it's probably a slightly false position.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to look at Samp. Samp are much better than 14th suggests.
And Fiorentina.
Yeah. Okay, Jonathan, let's talk about Spain.
Let's talk about Spain.
Valencia, top. Now, is this because Valencia have, you know, they've put all their troubles behind them, and you know they think, oh, actually, no, we're not multi-hundreds of millions of pounds in debt. Everything is fine from now on.
Well, it was it's an interesting Jedi sort of mind trick that the Valencia board played. Obviously, it's been well known for a number of years now that they have serious financial problems. They're currently in upwards of 400 million euros worth of debt. And obviously it was clear that they would have to sell some of their best players. David Villa left in the summer, as did David Silva. But it was a very interesting sort of trick that the board played, which was basically to deny everything. If you remember, I mean, the season before this, in other words, the start of the 2009-10 season, Villa and Silva were expected to leave, but they remained, and it was kind of thought then that, you know, they would literally be sold for a pittance, and that they would leave, for not too much money because of the problems Valencia were having financially. They have 2 stadiums, one of them they can't build, a new Mestalla, and one they can't sell, the one that they currently occupy, and it was thought that they would struggle to they would sell all their best players and still be in mountains of debt. But conveniently, the board basically said, what debt are you talking about? We don't really, you know, they played a hard bargain and they managed to extract 90 million euros worth of money from the players they sold over the summer, which is an incredible amount, really, when you consider that last summer they didn't sell the players like Villa and Silva. So you would have thought that a year later their value would have gone down with everyone realising that Valencia were in big trouble. So the board have done fantastically well, actually, in the way that they've manipulated the situation to raise 90 million. And in fact, they claim that they've eliminated 150 million euros worth of debt over the last year. So in a sense...
Did they waft their fingers around while they were doing that? perhaps. Credits will do.
perhaps. But the interesting thing about Valencia is that they've through their problems and through the problems financially and at the boardroom level, they've kind of rallied round. And Unai Emery, who's the Valencia manager, who's one of the brightest young managers in Spain, tipped to be the next Spain manager when Del Bosque eventually leaves after Euro 2012. And he's the players he's brought in, you know, he didn't complain about losing, obviously, one of the world's best strikers and attacking midfielders. He simply replaced them with fine players like Aritz Aduriz, who's coming for 4 million euros from Athletic Bilbao, and Roberto Soldado. They were two of the best scoring strikers in Spain outside of Barcelona and Real Madrid. And he's gelled a team, and he's bought players in every position to replace the kind of star names. And they've prospered from it. They've really been playing extremely well. They're still unbeaten. And whether or not they can carry that on all season and kind of challenge the big two, who are, as you'll notice, not in the top two at the moment, remains to be seen. But what's clear at the moment is they're a very good team, and they have the depth to be able to sustain a challenge, at least for the top four, certainly.
Cool. Excellent. Looking down the table, I see Deportivo on the bottom.
They're
there.
Awful. They're terrible.
Yeah. No wins from six. At least Deportivo have actually done the right thing this season and disappointed from the start rather than starting well and then just fading away like they always do.
They made Real Madrid look like a prolific team when they lost 6-1 there, which was more down to Deportivo just being terrible rather than Real Madrid being superb. And they it was their first goal from open play actually against Real Madrid in the league this season, and I don't know where their next goal from open play will come, because they really are that bad at the moment.
Dark times for Depot. Let's go to France. Chris, what can you tell us what's going on there? Stade Rennes
or Rennes to their friends. excuse me. Yes. The slightly sort of topsy-turvy look to the table at the moment. You've got Rennes, who are one of only two sides unbeaten that are at the top of the moment, leading just by a point in front of Saint-Etienne, which means that we probably will get our Sarah Cracknell reference in.
Yay! I think we just have, haven't we?
Yes, there we go.
Bing!
Still no sign of the sort of front runners from recent seasons like Marseille, Bordeaux, Lyon, although Bordeaux and Marseille are now hauling themselves up the table. Marseille are up to eighth. But Lyon's still struggling, only one place above the relegation zone. They got a rare win in their last game, but it was enough to sort of see them lifted very high up the table, so they're still struggling. But at the top, you've got Rennes, who are traditionally in recent years have been a good sort of top 10 side, a side that kind of usually puts in a good show and is in with a good chance of getting into the Europa League. And they've started off really well, five wins and three draws from their eight games.
Just out of interest, Chris, because admittedly I don't keep as close an eye on the French league as others, but Rennes I've seen big money transfers take place between sides and Rennes, Petr Cech being one, Asamoah Gyan another. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are plenty of others who just don't spring to mind at the moment. Are Rennes a team who are just kind of a feeder club for big sides, or do you think that they can mount a serious title challenge with the players that they've got?
I think they're probably overdue a strong title challenge, but it's interesting you mentioned another one is Jimmy Briand, who I think I mentioned on the last podcast. He was one of the sort of two main signings that Lyon made during the summer. The thing with Rennes is that going back, I think it was about 10 years or so, they got heavy financial backing by the patron of a big sort of chain of stores over in France, and they got a lot of money. And the first thing they did was they then started to buy South American players, and it was a complete failure. Every player they bought pretty much didn't work out. And so what they've tended to do now is to bring through players from their youth academy, excuse me, which is why what you tend to find happens is that they get some great players coming through, and the minute they really kind of get into their stride, they get snapped up by people. So that's kind of what Rennes are all about. But they are a good side for all that. Whether they've got the wherewithal to do any better this season, I'm not entirely sure. I think they'll probably be aiming for Europa League, which tends to be their season-on-season ambition, really. And St Etienne, who are doing tremendously well, had a bit of an indifferent start to the season. Then they had a run of 5 wins on the trot. And have actually done really well, got good results, got a draw against Marseille, and they beat Lyon. Rennes haven't really played anyone decent yet, it has to be said. They've played sort of pretty easy teams so far, so I'm not sure if Rennes will stay at the top, but an interesting look to the top of the table at the moment.
Terry, tell us about Germany. Mainz. The mighty Mainz.
Mighty Mainz.
They roll on.
100%. Played 7-1-7. Easy. Extraordinary. Mainz, provincial club, really. Small club, 25,000 capacity stadium. Soon to be moving into a brand new one. But Thomas Tuchel took over the club the season before last, at the very beginning of the season, on the eve of the season. Jorn Andersen was sacked just when they were about to start their new season back in the Bundesliga. And he took them to 9th place, and everyone thought, well, that's marvellous, isn't it great? Mainz will have a bit of a, you know, have a bit of a transitionary season this season, and we'll see what happens when they move into this new stadium of theirs. And they've in fact done is they've gone on this massive winning streak, including such scalps as Bayern Munich and the lesser. A scout by Stuttgart. Lewis Holtby is probably their most famous player that's certainly on these shores anyway, because of his of English collection, Evertonian, half Scouse, and it's been suggested that he might be picked for England, which I think was always ludicrous.
Bit of hoo-ha sort of around end of last month, wasn't there, about him? He was sort of like sort of touted around I think the English press suddenly woke up to it.
They realised who it was, and I suspect what happened was is that he was asked the question, would you like to play for England, to which, being a very polite man, he sort of said, well, no.
And clever as well.
Thanks for
he's
asking.
He's obviously been spending a lot of time in Germany.
I was born in Germany, and I speak German. I'm the captain of the German under-21 team. I am German. I think I'll play for Germany. Thanks very much. But it's very nice of you to ask. I understand he harbours secret dreams of playing for Everton one day. Because his old man's an Evertonian. But he's a superb player. He's actually a Schalke player. Been on loan at Bochum the season before last. Didn't get straight into the team at Schalke. Felix Magath curiously chose not to put him into the first team squad and sent him out on loan again. Schalke are second from bottom. Must be wondering whether or not perhaps they might have made a bit of an error there. But clearly felt the guy needed more time, and he doesn't, because he's very much linchpin behind that. But it shouldn't be stressed enough that Thomas Tuchel is doing a very good job there. He mixes things up tactically. He seems to be utilising his squad. And although they're not household names, they are clearly very good. And no one really knows what's going to happen next. But Will Mainz, the assumption is that they will eventually fall away. And my feeling is they'll be like Hertha from 2 years ago when they started brilliantly.
Well, Hoff.
And Hoffenheim to an extent, although I'm comparing it more with Hertha, because I think Hoff's decline was very immediate.
Mm.
They had the winter break. They won the winter championship, had the winter break, and then suddenly went boom. They had to they moved to their new stadium, funnily enough, and it all went horribly wrong from there. Whereas Hertha's decline was a little bit more gradual, and they ended up because they were still contesting for the title at the end, and I wonder whether or not that might be more of Mainz's story. But You know, I mean, Bayern will need to go some to catch up at this stage, even at this stage of the season.
And of course, just one place behind Mainz is Dortmund, and you know they've put six wins on the spin themselves.
Yeah, they have indeed, and they're
just, they're
doing incredibly well. I mean, this is interesting. There's the Mainz connection here as well because. Jürgen Klopp, the coach of Borussia Dortmund, used to be the coach of Mainz and took them into European competition, albeit through the Fair Play League, where the last time Mainz were any good, and kept them up in consecutive, I think, four, perhaps five consecutive seasons in there. They are perennially a second division club, Mainz. So he did a very good job there, and he got the gig at Borussia Dortmund and has taken a very long time over it. Dortmund have not been splashing the cash around, not since the last time they did that. It all went horribly wrong, and they suffered from their own share of debts. And Klopp has come in by slowly bringing in good players. Obviously, Nuri Sahin is a player that a lot of people are talking about. Lucas Barrios is probably my favourite, a fantastic goal scorer, although no one is really entirely sure why. But nevertheless, he is there. But the two centre-halves of Subotic and Mats Hummels, both 21 years old, both very, very good, and they've been playing together for a little while now. And they're going to, you know, if they stay together at Dortmund, then Dortmund, I think, have got an excellent chance. They've got an excellent chance of winning the Bundesliga this season.
Because, you know, there's a lot of big names that have made awful starts, isn't there, really? Bayern already, 13 points off the top.
Mm.
Down there as well, you've got Bremen. Obviously the bottom two, you've still got Schalke. Well,
the bottom two is extraordinary.
Schalke still, and Stuttgart.
Stuttgart have sacked their coach today, Christian Gross. This time last year, they sacked Marcus Babbel and brought Christian Gross in, and they had a big bounce, and they ended up qualifying for Europe from pretty much the position where they are now. And the year before that, they were pretty much down the bottom as well, and they sacked their coach Armin Fee and replaced him with Marcus Babbel. And so they seem to be moving into this sort of horrific sort of like pattern of abuse.
Mm.
And it's I've no idea how much it's costing them in managers' wages. Jens Keller is the caretaker boss there. If you Google him, make sure you put the S on the end of Jens and not Jen Keller, who I believe is a bikini babe. You may, may find more than you bargained for. I know I did. So just a word of warning there. But yeah,
You mean fruity chicks?
How long was it before you actually typed the right spelling in, Terry? That's
what I it wasn't long after that my Google and my HTC browser stopped working. But I must very quickly mention Schalke. 4 points there. Finished second last season. The Felix Magath did a fantastic job, but he's moved so many players on, and clearly hasn't been able to. He's gone for a mixture of youth and then the big headliners of Raul and Huntelaar, and it's clearly taking time there. Although Huntelaar is just as expected, taken to the Bundesliga like a duck to water. He's going there and he's scoring, but at the moment seems to be only scoring consolation goals. So they need to sort their stuff out quite soon.
Okay, and with that, I think it's time to call a halt to this Euro Fact Fest. Thank you for sticking with us, and we hope you'll join us again in another month or so, where we'll no doubt have a good look at the Champions League and the Europa Leagues, as well as some top action from around the continent. Until then, from myself and from all my guests, goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.